Well, because I usually sit where you are sitting, I suspect that some of you might have questions like, who is this guy really? And why should I listen to him? That's fair. I've been asking myself the same questions. Mother Amanda, as she mentioned, approached me months ago, wondering if I would be willing to preach some Sunday. I balked at the suggestion because I wondered what I could possibly have to say that would be of any value to anyone listening. You see, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool modernist, schooled in the paradigm of certainty that has dominated Western culture for the last several hundred years. But a few decades ago, I found my theological and philosophical journey wandering into postmodern territory, where all certainty is called into question. This journey has required me to re-examine what I thought I knew to be true and reevaluate what I thought it meant to be a citizen in the kingdom of truth. All that to say, I wasn't sure I could speak with any authority and offer anything with any confidence that would benefit my listeners. But then again, all followers of Jesus are saddled with this same uncertainty, whether we want to admit it or not. We are in pursuit of knowing a God we cannot apprehend with the human senses. We are forced to pursue God through faith, not certainty, which in the words of the author of Hebrews is an assurance of things hoped for and a conviction of things not seen. We do not have the privilege of Thomas, who refused to believe until he saw the wounds and touched them with his hands. We do not, however, operate with a blind faith, but with an informed faith, informed by the human intellect and reason that God has given to all of us. So followers of Jesus are fellow travelers trying to know the invisible God with eyes of faith, hoping to discover his kingdom of peace and joy in the midst of the chaos of a very broken world. So I invite you to join me in this morning in that pursuit. Our passage from the gospel reading today is an excerpt from a sermon given by Jesus and recorded in Luke, known as the Sermon on the Plain. It resembles a much longer message of Jesus recorded in Matthew 5-7, known as the Sermon on the Mount. There is great debate among interpreters whether Luke has recorded an abbreviated version of the longer sermon in Matthew or whether the two sermons are delivered by Jesus on two different occasions. I have no intention of stumbling around in those debates this morning, and I leave it to your own study. I will, however, refer to both sermons since the section in today's liturgy so closely resembles Matthew's. So I'd like to explore several questions this morning. First of all, who is my enemy? Well, apparently there were no lawyers at this particular sermon to ask this question, as there had been to pose the question, who is my neighbor, on another occasion. But it would have been in keeping with rabbinic practice to have debated this topic. Most of Jesus's listeners would have identified Rome as Israel's number one enemy. Romans were interlopers, trespassers, occupiers of their God-given land. And most Jews had no small amount of animosity toward these foreigners. A similar animosity was directed toward tax collectors. Tribute paid to Rome was considered unjust. In addition, corruption abounded among these government officials. Special contempt was reserved for Jewish tax collectors, those people who had crossed enemy lines to work for Rome. A third group of enemies would be the impure and unrighteous Gentiles, those who were not among the chosen people of God. Hatred towards them may have been toned down to disgust or coldness, but they were still treated as enemies. And for good measure, throw in the Samaritans, who were considered theological enemies and were the object of alienation. For the Jews, the enemy was not that difficult to identify. When I played competitive sports, the enemy was the team on the other side of the field or the court. When I reached college, the enemy was the communists trying to spread their ideology in Indochina. But soldiers who fought there were taught to greatly expand their identification of the enemy beyond military combatants only. Villagers, even children, were co-opted by the Viet Cong as covert militants, and they became enemies. Meanwhile, an expansion was infecting American society at home. People on opposite sides of the Vietnam issue became hostile and even violent. Vets returning home from that horrific war were treated as enemies by many Americans. In the ensuing five decades, political opponents have more frequently been called enemies as political rhetoric has become increasingly hateful. We are breeding a culture of enmity. And identifying our enemies may not be as difficult as it once was. But I suspect that Jesus would want us to take a little closer inspection and think more individually. Who are those enemies with whom I interact personally? My initial response to this question is that I don't think I have any enemies. But on more careful reflection, perhaps I am being naive. It seems we can acquire enemies in two different ways. The first way is active. We make them. The Latin word for enemy is inimicus, from in, meaning not, and amicus, meaning friend. Broadly speaking, then, an enemy is whomever we decide not to treat as a friend. There are people we would be reluctant to label as an enemy, but if we harbor some ill will toward them and treat them with anything less than friendliness or kindness, then we are treating them as an enemy. The second way we acquire enemies is passive. We are declared or merely treated as an enemy by someone else. Perhaps you said or did something that another person didn't like, and you have become an object of some degree of antagonism. Or your belief systems or political ideologies conflict. We are sometimes unaware of the well-hidden dislike from others, but we can usually recognize barriers that people erect. From the innocent wisdom of Peppermint Patty, when your teacher doesn't like you, there's nothing you can do about it. If we really bore down to the core of Jesus' instruction, we may discover we have more enemies than we want to acknowledge. There are many people with whom we disagree or who disagree with us, but in God's kingdom, there is no room for hate. So let's say that an enemy has appeared on our radar. So the second question I would like to pose is, how does Jesus say we should manage that relationship? In both Luke and Matthew, Jesus' instruction is simple. Love your enemies, which is anything but simplistic. We learn in Matthew that rabbinic disputation had led some rabbis to teach that the law encourages them to love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Now, this is probably more palatable to most humans, whether Jews in the first century or us in the 21st. Jesus, however, is teaching a way of life that surpasses the natural way of life. He teaches a law that is born out of divine convention, not human convenience. The way of Jesus is the way of God's kingdom. And kingdom law can be summed up in one law, the law of love. It is clear from New Testament references that kingdom love transcends some sublime emotional state. Kingdom love is intentional as it pursues the good of the one loved. It is the desire of kingdom love to bring about peace and human flourishing to everyone in our sphere of influence, neighbor or enemy. In Luke 6:27-30, Jesus indicates this love must be active. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who abuse you. If anyone strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. And from anyone who takes away your coat, do not withhold even your shirt. Give to everyone who begs from you. And if anyone takes away your goods, do not ask for them again. That's quite a list. Doing good requires interaction with our enemies. We cannot love them from afar or merely in our hearts. I would have been much more at home if Jesus had said, avoid your enemies and thereby maintain the peace. Well, that would seem to be a form of love. I could say that I love them while circumventing any opportunity to prove my words. But the kind of love that Jesus expects actively engages with those who hate us, curse us, and abuse us. John made this very distinction in his first epistle. But if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Little children, let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth. One action instructed by Jesus does stand out. You can find in many pre-Christian writings something similar to loving those who hate you or not taking revenge on those who hurt you. But turning the other cheek is not found in any other moral or ethical teachings outside of the New Testament. This is a hard saying indeed. Implied in this action is a willingness to forgive those who harm us in such a way that we become vulnerable to further mistreatment from them. What is forbidden by this teaching is retaliation in any form. Our reading in Psalm 37, verse 9, alludes to this same idea. Refrain from anger. Leave rage alone. Do not fret yourself. It leads only to evil. In the story of Joseph, his brothers had become his enemies. But when he was in a position to take revenge on them, he exercised forgiveness and deep love for them. More than one biblical writer exhorts us to be slow to anger, because the anger of man does not assist the righteousness of God. Kingdom love is antithetical to human retribution. Unfortunately, we do not live in a society that promotes a habit of loving enemies. Quite the opposite. Movies, TV, 24-hour news, and especially social media incite fear. And fear engenders hostility. It is the natural response to those who disagree with us, who are different from us, who threaten us and our way of life. This incessant message has a way of seeping into our psyche. The kingdom mindset to which Jesus calls us diametrically opposes an ethos of fear, hatred, and oppression. Jesus knew this kind of hostility. He was hounded by those who feared and hated him. He was harshly criticized, rejected, and condemned. Yet he always extended kindness and grace to his enemies. Even as he was suffering the violent loathing of his enemies on the cross, he prayed for them. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. It seems that this would have been a good place for Jesus to insert his parable of the Good Samaritan as an example of loving your enemy. The priest and the Levite failed to love even their neighbor. Passing by the injured Jewish man and avoiding an uncomfortable or inconvenient situation. The Samaritan, on the other hand, an enemy to Jews, one who was labeled an outsider, practices kingdom love. He interrupted his journey. He bandaged the injured man. He transported the man to an inn where he attended to him overnight. He invested in the man, assuring the innkeeper he would take care of all expenses while the man convalesced. Wow. That is some serious act of love. I have difficulty getting past just interrupting my journey. But then Jesus never said it would be easy to follow him. So that brings me to a third question. What does Jesus use as the rationale for this love? Both Luke and Matthew offer the same motivation. You will be children of God. The child of God has experienced love in its perfection. The love that God has poured out on all of us in our salvation, which includes his forgiveness, his mercy, his deliverance from slavery to sin and death, his acceptance, his eternal promises, and the list goes on. It is no small thing to walk in this kind of love every day. Consequently, we should act consistently with this identity as children of the God who is love. To be his children is to act like his children. Kingdom love is God's love transforming us and empowering us to love as he does. And how does God love our enemies? Matthew explains that he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the righteous and on the unrighteous. Contrary to some belief systems, God is not a punitive God. His love and mercy abound to all people, not just to those who claim to believe in him. When did we experience God's love? While we were enemies to him. As Romans 5:10 says, "For if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his Son, much more now that we are reconciled, shall we be saved." In Jesus' act of loving his enemies, he turned the other cheek, allowing his enemies to hang him on a cross, where he removed the barrier of sin and death and created a way for the salvation of the enemies of God. Some caveats are in order here. Jesus' call to love your enemy is much more complex than we have time to explore this morning. Let me give you a few things that it's not. It's not some panacea for solving all the conflicts in the world. It is not the only condition for reconciliation and restoration between those who are in conflict. It does not address systemic injustice where some people are treated with greater privilege and respect than others. It is not intended to create a pseudo-contentment for the oppressed. Jesus is not calling his followers to passively suffer at the hands of our oppressors while failing to address the sin of the victimizers and holding them accountable. This enemy love does not expect victims to continue to subject themselves to abuse if they have other options. All of those caveats could be a sermon into themselves. Former Archbishop Rowan Williams offers some insights into the context of Jesus' words. The Jewish people of the first century were very familiar with abusive treatment from enemies, such as the demeaning requirement to carry a soldier's pack, the theft of possessions through an unethical tax system, or the humiliation of being slapped by a Roman soldier. This act of violence was an expression of power and control. But turning the other cheek was an act of resistance. Williams writes, "The world of the aggressor, the master, is questioned because the person who is supposed to take no initiative suddenly does. It is anything but passive. It is an act of kingdom love, rejecting a power of contrived superiority and offering peace under a greater authority. The nonviolent strategy of the civil rights movement in the 60s is a perfect illustration of this kind of resistance. In her book, How to Have an Enemy, Righteous Anger in the Work of Peace, Melissa Flohr Bixler, a pastor in the Mennonite Church and a graduate of Princeton Theological Seminary, writes, "It is easier to reduce Jesus' teaching on enemy love to an ethical injunction, a set of rules we can parcel out to shift our behavior. Instead, Jesus calls us to publicly imagined possibilities of transformation that break open a renewed order. Only then can we love our enemy as we proclaim that their terror no longer has power over us." Loving your enemies renounces the entrenched power structures of the world and offers a new system of order and peace, of respect and forgiveness. Love your enemies so that you may be children of your Father in heaven and demonstrate to the world that there is a kingdom where justice, peace, and love coexist in perfect balance, a kingdom that was inaugurated on a Roman cross, where the power of all of our enemies was shattered. This is indeed the good news of the gospel.